Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell.
And hello out there in Radio Land. It is time for the best political talk show you've never heard of. It is Backroom Politics from Studio A in Podcast Village in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. Joining me as they do every time in studio, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. He is the one we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And at my 11 o'clock, he is the retired one-star admiral from your United States Navy, the one we know as Admiral Ken Carradine. Hello, Admiral Ken.
On furlough from Boca del Vista.
That's right. Apparently, you got the hall pass. And directly to my 1 o'clock, he is the former Democrat, or he's currently, I guess you could call him, Democratic political operative, former Biden political operative, and attorney in Washington, D.C., Dan Lipner. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Justin.
And, dude, that is just so creepy. You know what, dude? Just really? Really? No, you're not allowed to do that. Well, in the cage with us today is Oscar. Hello, Oscar.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
And somewhere out there in the hinterlands of upstate New York is our producer, Audrey Howerton. Lots of stuff going on. We just got word, which we'll probably talk about hopefully here in another segment, but we just got word that the latest proposal from Theresa May's planned Brexit is failed miserably again, putting her on her heels. That's going to be an interesting discussion. We'll get to that here later. But one of the things we do want to talk about today, in case you did not hear or you were living underneath some sort of comfortable rock, President Trump yesterday put out his budget for 2020, a stunning $4.7 trillion budget, a record budget put out by the White House. The presidential budget request is I've heard Democrats call it an acid trip, a delusional reality. Republicans are saying this is the new norm as far as spending goes, but deficit spending be damned. They just put full steam ahead on putting money out there. It is the big news coming out of the budget is the big concern. President Budget is literally going 180. He is violating a campaign promise that he stood firm on, but he is literally killing Medicare, Medicaid, and it is noticeable. Let's go.
Wait, well, this president doesn't keep his word?
I know, shocking. Let's go to the amount first. Admiral Ken, President Trump was talking about, I'm going to balance the budget. I'm going to balance the budget. I'm going to be fiscally conservative. Look what I can do. I'm a businessman. I know how to run a business. He has literally put forth the largest budget request in the history of American government. And even his own Office of Management and Budget puts out numbers that say that they won't be able to touch spending down the deficit for 15 years, which means that he has literally sealed a deal for deficit spending for the next decade. This deficit spending is not only a flip-flop on a promise, but this could potentially hurt the people that put him into office. Why aren't people up at arms about this, or are they?
I think that the Republican Party that we knew as young men, even up until maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I'll be generous, it is gone. And there does not seem to be anything left that describes why it was the party of Lincoln and the party of Reagan. The idea that we should live not above our means and try and push back crazy numbers like the ones we're seeing in this budget seems to have disappeared from the landscape. I think in older times, you might have thought that members of the Senate and the Congress of the party would push back on this. But as it just came out, I don't think we've had an opportunity to see that. But if their behavior is in line with what we've seen in the last year or so, I don't expect there to be much in the way of resistance, and I think you're probably going to see continued enablement.
Alan Moore, is big-time deficit spending the new norm regardless of party now?
No, it's not the new norm. It's the old norm. we've had that norm now for a long time. But as Ken points out, it wasn't that many years ago where at least the Republicans agonized over it, tried to resist, tried to fight.
That was what the Tea Party came into power about.
There was a lot of things, but they never did it. Right. It's this insidious marriage of the parties, not over how to spend the deficits, but whether to just have a big deficit. So what that means is that this president's budgets, this is his third one, is just like Obama's budgets in that it's debt on arrival. It's a political statement, which doesn't mean there isn't content there that at some level the administration or portions of it are serious about. But when he proposes to increase defense spending a full 5% on top of the increases of the last couple of years and then pay for it in dribs and drabs and bits and pieces, not, by the way, out of Medicare and Medicaid, but basically out of every other impossible, unrealistic agency cuts and other agency budgets that range sort of from 10% to 30% in the case of EPA. Won't happen. Can't happen.
But here's and I want to go to you on this, Alan, from a government economics aspect, is there seems to be a lack of coordination, shocking, between the White House, OMB, and the federal. The president is literally putting out rose-colored sunglasses budget. He's predicting 3.2% growth over the next fiscal year, which is contrary to his own Federal Reserve's growth predictions of 2.3%. Is that kind of miscoordination or misinterpretation dangerous to our economy?
Well,
or to the fiscal stability of the government?
It's nothing new that the administrations put out rosier estimates, typically. White Houses put out typically rosier estimates than do the Fed, or for that matter, the Congressional Budget Office, both of which tend to be more neutral, if you will, in their estimates. Having said that, their estimates, sometimes they're exceeded. The growth in the last 2 years by this president has exceeded what it didn't achieve the 4% he was talking about, which was just out of the blue numbers, but it did exceed the numbers predicted by both the Fed and the CBO.
Okay, hold on. Dan Lipner, then Admiral Ken.
So there's a bunch of things to unpack there. So first,
just do one real quick.
Hey, Alan got two bites of the apple there.
I'll give you one and a half. Go.
So the first and foremost, while the economic growth has been not half bad, the government revenue has been down. The tax cuts that were supposed to pay for themselves are clearly not. So the growth in the deficit is partially due to those tax cuts. So let's start there. Yes, there's also the issue of spending. There was a period during the Clinton administration, they actually said they were going to just go with the CBO numbers. The White House was not going to come up with their own numbers as far as the economic growth. Then the Republicans took over, and then everything went in separate directions again. But there was a two-year window where everyone was playing with the same set of numbers. As far as this president and these budget cuts, these budget numbers, they don't make sense. Even as a policy document, you would like to throw some sugar at somebody that you like other than the Department of Defense. Those folks in Arizona.
Now, wait a minute. Hold on. Department of Defense. I mean, look, the three big winners here are Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, and the Veterans Administration. The big losers here is everybody else in government.
Right. And so in all due respect, there's a finite number of people who make money as far as let's be clear, the military contractors who make the equipment that are going to be the biggest beneficiaries of the DOD budget increase, because I believe salaries and for soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are not going up. I believe that was capped last time around. So the VA numbers, okay, yeah, the VA is a mess and it's a really expensive agency. I'm not against spending money there.
I am.
Go ahead.
Oh, we'll get to that. Hold on.
That said, it's still a policy document, and you're supposed to at least be showing some love to somebody. That Medicare number is a real number.
We'll get to that.
What that's going to mean electorally for him is insane.
Admiral Ken, first of all, go to you. And then
two things.
Break it down.
One, the concept of the president not listening to authoritative voices within his administration and doing something that's in line with his thinking, no matter how flawed that might be, is not an unusual situation. We've been here before, kids. We really have. Number two, the idea that that we're going to throw more good money after bad in some of the agencies that are not doing as well as they should be, despite clear options of doing other things. Again, not unusual. We've been here before as well. I being a vet, nothing would please me more than to see the VA become a much better version of itself. But I have seen no reason to believe that more money is going to solve that problem.
Alan Moore, there is the big ticket takedown on this seems to be the fact that President Trump in 2015 and 2016 made the promise he would not touch Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and yet there is an $8 billion hit to Medicare, Medicaid in this budget request. How does the White House justify that type of hit on non-discretionary spending?
I assume that he will do what he does every time.
Why?
Which is deny that he said something, A, and B, deny that what he's proposing is in violation to whatever it was that he said. Having said all that, cuts in those social programs don't come because a president changes his mind or stakes out a position. They come as a result of a bipartisan group coming together and concluding that for the good of the country, some changes have to be made. That process, which we've come kind of close a few times, the famous Simpson-Bowles Commission that we spent a lot of time here talking about in the Obama administration is not part of what's going on here. So this is a matter of the president feeling vulnerable because there's no clear progress on reducing the annual deficit, bringing down the accumulated national debt, hearing about it from some of his friends, especially at a time when the economy is going strong. We can debate the details of that if we want. And so he said, we need to show some progress in reducing the deficit. Find it. He's not a detail guy, so they throw something together here. I mean, that's a little unfair. A lot of people spend a lot of time on putting it together.
You're talking $845 billion cut to Medicare.
It's not in a single year. I mean, here's
the
problem.
No, it's over the 10 years, but
still. It's $1 trillion it's close to $1 trillion program. I mean, it's you have to look at the details. Typically, when you're going after Medicare, you're going after hospitals, doctors, and drug expenses, and of course, leaving patients alone. It doesn't work that way in the real world. But you have to look at the
right.
A. You have to look at the details. But B. Then to turn that into actual policy, you need to show some movement, momentum in the Congress. I mean, I'm not seeing.
There's no support for it in Congress.
Well, there is actually, but nothing you'd see unless it became bipartisan and grew out of a process.
But you've got Nancy Pelosi, who pretty much guaranteed it was going to see the circular bin file when it gets her desk. I've had even one Republican staffer tell me this thing's probably dead on arrival.
I have never seen a budget in recent years sent up by a president that was not dead on arrival in the minds of a lot of the people who were receiving it.
Well, and that's true. But the question is, it's a policy proposal document, and what was he trying to get from this? It's not quite clear to me what his upside was at. Who was the love note to? It's not clear.
But here's the funny thing about that, though, is in past years, when George W. Bush, as much contention as he had had with Congress, the PBR was at least somewhat reasonable effort to at least show some sort of idea of this is my starting point, you give me yours. And they would take it, they would go through the process, they would take it to conference, and we would get the appropriation, we get the spending bills.
Oh, exactly. But and it's still these are the priorities I want out there.
But
other
this
than
to me,
him saying, again, the list that we've already covered, who are the regular people that benefit from this budget? Well, it's not clear.
I mean, Admiral Ken, you're talking about cuts to farm subsidies at a time when tariffs are killing farmers on a daily basis. How do you justify that? I mean, that's
this
not going to win you.
Tariffs that he's managed to get this trade war.
And you're cutting the subsidies that are going to help offset the pain from those tariffs.
I think probably for the millionth time that we've sat around this table, either in virtually or in person, you know, we're trying to apply some level of rationality to things that don't require or can stand up to that kind of analysis. You know, I think back to the Medicare piece, you know, having done the detailed reading on this, you know, to answer your question, he's looking at making up the difference by ferreting out fraud, waste, and abuse. Now, that sounds really great on paper.
It's not enough.
It sounds really great on paper. The problem is anytime you go after something like that, you've got to look at three components: leadership, process, and technology. And you got to be able to do them all. And there's no reason to believe that kind of mindset is going to take place.
But you could
overnight.
You could literally recover 10% annually, according to several people that I've talked to at CMS. You're talking about recovering 10% annually of the cuts. You're talking $800 million in recovery.
Best case scenario.
If you went after Medicaid, Medicare fraud.
Yeah.
If CMS was serious about it. So, okay, I'll give the president that. If that is his intent, go get him, cowboy.
Well,
I'm all over that.
Enforcement costs money, too.
Well, the problem is, you know, two of those things are really difficult to do. The leadership change and the process redesign is really hard to do. The tech piece is easy. Just go out and find a new machine, except that can be expensive, too, if you don't do the other two. So, again, you know, what it comes down to is will and direction and drive. And quite frankly, does anyone at this table believe that CMS has got those in enough quantities to make that happen?
Alan Moore.
Yeah. So a couple of things on the Medicare piece, because that's the biggest piece here. It's a 10-year number. The president has directed that there shall be savings of this amount. He hasn't said how, but the focus is on not just the waste, fraud, abuse piece, but he's almost $300 million of the $800 is reclassified out of Medicare into the Department of HHS. So it's really just under it's in the 560, 570 range that we're looking at. But drugs is a big piece also, in addition to the waste, fraud, and abuse. And this administration has taken some steps that is actually seems to be making some difference in gaining some credit of reducing the cost of drugs, the price of drugs, if you will, that's paid. And if you can convert some of those savings into Medicare, which is a huge purchaser of drugs, you could conceivably find some dough, some significant amounts of money. All I'm saying is what they're trying to do is have their cake and eat it too.
But he's also trying to offset it by putting the responsibilities back on the states.
That's not Medicare. That's Medicaid. That's a whole different completely different program.
But you're talking about
two programs.
They're not the same. I understand it's two programs.
Well,
what I'm saying is
the states don't save the money on Medicare.
Medicaid, you're talking about funding that goes to all of CMS managed programs.
So CMS does Medicare
and
Medicaid.
Right. And what I'm saying is, but either or, both programs are taking a major hit. If you take Medicaid and you put that responsibility back on the states, that's just robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, what they're trying to do on Medicaid, and I'm not sure how much we want to be in the weeds here on these programs. We can talk a long time if you want. So Medicaid is cost sharing between the federal government and the states. Poorer states get a higher share of their spending than do wealthier states, and the states have some choices as to what kinds of services they provide. What Republicans have proposed and what they're proposing here is to convert Medicaid into a block grant program for the states where they will make more of the decisions for a fixed amount of money. It won't just be you spend it, you get reimbursed. It's highly controversial, but it's important to understand what's being proposed. Now, if you block grant and lock down the money and don't provide funds for increases, good luck serving all the needs of the people who've come to expect it.
Dan Lipner.
Right, and that's the big catch. And one of the big secrets on those kind of issues is those pesky little red states, for those of you who are Republicans, are actually bigger receivers than donors for those kind of programs. It's the blue states that are actually funding everyone else. But those are the pesky little details. But with the president, all of this is interlinked. So if I keep coming back to the tax cuts that went through, and the adjustments that went through, the adjustments in the SALT offset.
All right, but let me ask you this question. Hold on, Dan.
It's insane.
Dan, hold on. Let me ask you this question. You're talking about $241 billion reductions in Medicaid spending over the next 10 years. It's 24.
To be clear, that is the poorest and weakest amongst us.
So you're saying it's a shell game.
Not only is it a shell game, it's dangerous, and it's just going to make everything more difficult for those who actually provide care for those in need.
Admiral Ken, the other big takeaway on this is, for a president that's been talking about conservative values, he's a true conservative, this president literally has gone and said, hey, I'm going to increase fees. We're talking about increasing visa applications at State Department, CIS processing. He's talking about proposing an e-cigarette user fee. He's talking about increasing customs fees on an administration that's already in the hole on tariffs and everything. This doesn't seem like the right way to try and shift around revenue. Am I missing the boat on this?
Nope.
So how does the president justify, hey, I want smaller government, but by creating bigger government and all these agencies that are going to create fees?
So, you know, part of the problem here is that, there's some form of calculus that's going on inside of the White House. And every once in a while we'll get a document that defies, again, rational thought in trying to understand why this 2+2 equals something else in this administration. I honestly don't know. What I do know is this. We watched the president from the beginning of his campaign make a number of promises. As late as last week, Matt Schlapp went on one of the TV shows and was talking about the fact that, you know, the president is doing what he said he was going to do, with the exception of some major examples like getting Mexico to pay for a wall and now not cutting Medicare. But he continually is allowed, not only by Republicans in Congress and the Senate, but also by his followers, he's allowed to change course, and it's okay because that's the way he's going to lead things. I suspect that as much as we're churning on this subject, in a week or so, you will hear not really one complaint about it from his most vocal supporters. If anything, they will fall in line and they'll back his play, and they'll come up with some unique way of rationalizing why it's a good idea.
I mean, is the Republican Party just turned their only policy position is to be gaslighters? And for those of you who don't know the term, it's essentially just to irritate the other side, not to actually have a policy position other than to irritate people. And that's the nearest I can figure. The only positions they're taking are just to irritate folks and go, see, we've irritated the left. We've succeeded.
Alan Moore.
Dan, are you gaslighting us here around the table?
Yeah, he's been doing that for years. Alan Moore, this is the big question. It strikes me that there was nobody in their right mind in OMB or in the administration had to believe that this thing was going to see light of day. But traditionally, as we pointed out before, these presidential budget requests have always been kind of a message, even kind of a starting point. This one almost seems like a finger towards Capitol Hill, middle finger towards Capitol Hill. Are they literally setting the ground rules for what is going to end up being another budget fight at the end of the fiscal year? Are we talking another government shutdown fight?
Well, I mean,
because Larry Kudlow said, yeah, possibly over the weekend.
If there is another shutdown, it will be over spending bills, not budget proposals from administrations. I'm intrigued with the notion that it's a finger to Capitol Hill. As we said at the outset, in recent memory, there is no budget. Every budget is a political document. It doesn't mean it's devoid of content. It doesn't mean that it's not in some measure a serious attempt to say, here's what we could do. Here's what we would do if we had the power to do it. And then watch and be involved in the congressional budgeting and more important appropriations process. And where it's going to get sorted out. If a president has particular longstanding positions on increasing spending in an area or decreasing it elsewhere, that can make a difference. Last year, in the last 2 years, defense spending has gone up more than the rest of government. And that was a recognition that, A, the president was pushing hard, but also a recognition on the part of majorities, both the House and Senate, that much as challenging as it was, they would support that. But we've got a new Congress now, and this proposal is going to add to defense and cut elsewhere. Good luck with that.
Yeah, yeah. On top of the fact that there's one other thing, the federal workers, they're going to be paying more into their retirement. They're going to be pay frozen. This is a nightmare.
Oh, just wait till this first round of AARP mailings go out in response to this.
Oh, yeah.
The Donald's going to enjoy
the
that
folks
one.
The folks at E Street are going to go off. Can't wait to see this. Anyway, we're going to come back. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about comments made by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She doesn't think an impeachment would be a good idea. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics. That's the way I feel you today.
Living. I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today. making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel you today.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell.
And we're back here in Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., your national capital. It is the best political talk show you've never heard of, Backroom Politics. I'm in studio with Alan Moore, Admiral Ken, Dan Lipner, Oscar behind the cage. Keeping us honest, we're going to change gears for a second. We want to talk about the latest in Capitol Hill kabuki dancing. In an odd turn, an odd shift in outward policy, Nancy Pelosi came out over the past 24 to 48 hours and pretty much came out and said that she did not believe that an impeachment was a good idea, and said, quote unquote, he's just not worth it. This is a little bit of a surprising turn of rhetoric coming from the Democratic Speaker of the House. Dan Lipner, let me start with you. She's your speaker.
She's our speaker.
That's true.
As I dislike him, Donald Trump is our president.
Our president, that's true.
Good point.
Nancy Pelosi is known to be a very shrewd, very politically savvy political operative when you're talking about this type of strategy. Some are saying this is a flip-flop. Are you buying that, or is this calculated?
I have not heard anyone saying it was a flip-flop. If anything, everything that's come out since is... This is the first time she said it publicly, and everyone now feels vindicated. It's behind the scenes. She's apparently been saying it for his administration thus far. She didn't think that impeachment was a good idea. The way she chose to approach the statement was very good, saying that he wasn't worth it, talking about unification of the country, that you didn't want to divide folks on these things and you needed Republicans to be on board. That was a very, very shrewd statement to basically lay things at the foot of the other side. So when the Mueller report comes out, the question is not going to be at Democrats' feet. It's going to be at Republicans. It was a very shrewd move.
Here's my question, Alan, is does it make political sense for her to take this approach when you have almost every oversight committee in the House conducting what some would believe are impeachable offense-finding excursions in oversight committee hearings?
Well, I think what she's trying to do several things to that particular question. She's trying to change the narrative from what it is that the committees are investigating. They're investigating wrongdoing on the part of this administration. They are not involved in some massive let's impeach the president exercise. And whether that is the collective view of all members, it's a good narrative. I think it's a defensible narrative. I found the timing a little bit odd because we may have the Mueller report within a week. It does suggest that she's not assuming that there's going to be grounds for impeachment in that Mueller report or seeds of it that would be then investigated more completely by the House. That's interesting. But she left herself some room. She said, from what we know now.
What I'm hearing you say is she's hedging her bets on the Mueller report.
No. She's not stupid. We've just commented on how smart and strategic she is. She said, from what we know now, I would not impeach. But she also acknowledges it needs to be bipartisan, which was what we experienced in the Bill Clinton impeachment. It wasn't bipartisan. It was a disaster for Republicans, a tremendous waste of time and energy. I think that the timing, though, was in part an effort to change the narrative of what's going on in the House from the question of whether Democrats are policing their own, whether Democrats are anti-Semitic, as the president charged bizarrely and strangely. rather than let that be the ongoing conversation about whether she can rein in these new folks, I think she concluded, it's time to say what publicly what I've been thinking, what she's been hinting at from the very beginning, and apparently saying behind the scenes. Yeah, I don't see us going towards impeachment.
I mean, Admiral Ken, I've said many times that this country does not bode well in an impeachment scenario. But it just seems to me that with, unfortunately, all of the clouds of e-cig vapor that could be smoke surrounding this administration, is Nancy Pelosi painting herself into a corner by saying, yep, no impeachment, regardless of what comes out in the Mueller report or what they find in oversight committees?
So if you listen to Fox News or any of the conservative radio people like Rush Limbaugh, for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 months or so, they've been presenting the picture that the Democratic Party is out to get Trump, and the only reason that that they did as well in the midterms was so they could get enough bodies in place to impeach him. And so that's been their narrative. And I think that part of the timing of this was to check that narrative, as Alan alluded to. The other side of this is the fact that when the Mueller report comes out, I think it's going to be clear as to whether there will be grounds for impeachment. If you look at the rest of her statement, it was something to the point that unless there's an overriding bipartisan reason to impeach, that's not something we're looking to do. So is she hedging her bets? I wouldn't say so, but I think what she's doing is, to your point, she's presenting the situation where, look, the report's going to come out. If it looks like he's done something that's untoward, that's worthy of impeachment, we're ready to go. Hey, Republicans, what are you going to do? And I guess finally, I've lived through the Clinton impeachment. As a high school student, I was there when people were preaching for Nixon to get impeached. And I think the other point that she made in her statement was right on target, that it is a terribly divisive activity for this country to participate in. And the last time we did this to a president, Justin, our party didn't fare too well.
No.
And you know what? If the Democrats haven't learned that you don't put a football team number of candidates up for president and expect it to come out good for you, they at least are looking at what happened in the last impeachment
process. Right. But Dan Lipner, here's where I get confused. You've got the speaker, saying, look, I don't want to go down this road. Impeachment's not a good idea. It's not worth it. And then you've got oversight. And you've got House Committee on Oversight and Reform. You've got judiciary. You've got intelligence. You've got ways and means. Four major committees that are literally calling for just about every document with a Trump signature out there. It sounds like to me Nancy either telegraphing, hey, let's rein this in a little bit, let's not get too aggressive, or...
Oh, absolutely not, no.
Then what's the reason for this, still allow them to go forward with something this deep?
Well, for starters...
I mean, Jerry Nadler's asked for every document under the sun.
It's called 2020.
There has been absolutely no oversight of this administration prior to the Democrats taking over the House. Everything from HHS and... Homeland Security, actually HHS is included, the number of issues that have gone on in this administration and the ongoing issues with the stupid Trump hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, possibly funneling money directly into the president's pockets, the T-Mobile merger
has
an emoluments clause. That's legitimate oversight.
It is a legitimate clause, but what I'm saying is, you bring up, DHS and HHS. I just saw a hearing with Kirstjen Nielsen. There was oversight on that hearing.
Right, the Democrats are doing
now.
That. Where was the oversight when the babies were being separated from their parents? Which, by the way, let's not ignore the fact that some of them still haven't been returned.
But
this stuff is a mess.
But why, if Nancy Pelosi is in fact saying, "Look, I don't want an impeachment," why?
No. She essentially has said it should not be a Our goals should not be predetermined. We are doing oversight, and the oversight will lead us where it goes.
Admiral Ken.
That is the purpose.
All right, hold on, Admiral Ken.
The strategy is clear. Political death by a thousand cuts. It's 2020. It's 2020. It's the main reason that President Trump did the emergency action ban, because he can say to his hang on, hold on. Go with me on this. It's the same reason that he went to the emergency action ban. Even if he gets shut down by the courts or by the Congress, he can say he did what he said he was going to do. She is basically positioning the party where there is going to be so much crap surrounding this president that 40% or 42% or so that he's barely hanging on to will dwindle down to something less than 30, and he can't come back from that. Right now, he's where he's where all the reelectable presidents were with regard to their popularity. Right now. So if that number goes down,
not by
the next
state.
Maybe not by state, but overall, if that number goes down, it presents a huge issue for him to overcome.
Yeah, but Alan Moore, we've got a lot of staff members and a lot of committee hours and time and resources going out of those four major committees, particularly out of judiciary. Jerry Nadler's got an entire army working on this thing. Could this backfire on the Democrats by going all in on oversight on the White House and the Trump administration instead of doing oversight on government as a whole?
Well, the problem is it's not visible to the public everything that the Congress is doing. They have asked for documents from 81 different individuals and organizations.
That's just judiciary.
Exactly. Right. Well, you mentioned judiciary,
right.
and that's Jerry Nadler's committee. But that is the place where any impeachment articles would emerge. Nadler himself has said, I want to get the facts that have been kept from us, and we will see where they take us. Nadler has also said publicly that one of the conditions of proceeding with impeachment, in addition to finding an impeachable offense, is bipartisanship. They recognize that you can't get it done in the Senate without a two-thirds vote of senators. I'll remind everyone, the House passes articles of impeachment, which it can do by a simple majority. Then there's a trial that occurs in the Senate where you need two-thirds votes of members present and voting to convict. They didn't come close with Bill Clinton. And with Richard Nixon, it wasn't until a group of his longtime Republican conservative senators like Barry Goldwater came down to him after seeing what was on some of the tapes that they said, Mr. President, we can no longer support you. Now, not many people think that we're going to get to that position regarding impeachment with President Trump. But that doesn't mean that you don't investigate those areas that you think require investigation, wrongdoing on the part of people in or around the president, not for the purposes of impeaching, but of discrediting again and again and again in time for the 2020 elections, not just the presidential elections, but also the congressional elections, which will all be part of 2020.
That's a risky bet. Why is it a risky bet?
Anyway, the Senate emergency vote, when is it scheduled for?
Thursday. I think it's this week.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, the number of Republicans that are going to flip on that is not going to be inconsequential.
But I mean,
it's at least four, and we'll see how many more join.
But this is
Alan's point. The Republicans that are in blue or purple states are ones that are most likely to be flipping, and a handful of ones that actually have some integrity.
Oh, no.
I think
Rand Paul's on. On board with
he's one of he's a big federalism guy.
And that's not exactly a blue state.
But Rand Paul's a big federalism guy. He's read the Constitution on this stuff.
Where's Cruz on that on this thing?
I don't know. He hasn't come out and said yet.
There's about 10 or 12 who have yet to decide, and they will.
It's the traditionals, the Murkowskis, the Collins. In the maple syrup crowd that are going to be on board with that
in Colorado. What's his name? His name's escaping me.
Who are you talking about?
There are two senators from Colorado, Bennett and the other guy.
Yeah, Corey.
Wait a minute. Anyway, I know you're talking about. I'll get it for you.
We are a credible political podcast. You know what?
465 legislators in this Congress.
Bell to miss one. 500. There's 435 in the House.
In the House.
Another 100 in the other chamber.
That's right. Oh, you're talking about the senator. That's right. 500. Anyway,
we are credible about talking about politics.
We are. Really, we know what we do. You can't know it all.
If
Oscar could find out for us, he's got a computer back there. He's working on
Gardner.
Thank you, Cory Gardner.
I had the Cory part. Come on, guys, give me a break.
I thought you said Booker.
No, I said Cory. Because Bennett is the other one.
Right.
We're talking about the Republican.
Cory Colorado, just so, to save time, like the president
Corey,
does.
Cory Apple.
Cory Apple. There we go. Let me ask you this question, though, Alan. I want to pose the same question to Dan as well. Is there a possibility that we might see events turn? Would the Republicans go to the White House and say, look, what we're getting out of Intel, what we're getting out of oversight, what we're getting out of Ways and Means, what we're getting out of Judiciary, we can't save you. You gotta go. The question is, would they go to the president with that? Or is he too strong?
It's just too big. It's too challenging a hypothetical. It Richard Nixon was strong, but they had him dead to rights. His words on tape, the so-called smoking gun that he knew about this conspiracy and therefore was part of it from the very beginning. Something he had denied. People had gone to the mat to protect him. And finally, when the text came out in that tape, they concluded they could no longer defend him. I'm not seeing something like that emerging, but I don't know what's going to emerge.
Yeah.
Neither does Nancy Pelosi, which is why she's given herself some room. It's why Jerry Nadler says, we're doing this investigation to see what we find. That's our job. That's what we do. And with regard to impeachment, he also, as did Pelosi, acknowledges it has to be bipartisan. So any sin that would become impeachable and potentially have two-thirds majority in the Senate would have to be so powerful, so overwhelming in its being obvious for what an egregious thing it is.
But their objective
is to win in 2020 and expand their majority in the House, perhaps take control of the Senate. This provides a useful mechanism, because no one can deny that it's not part of their responsibility.
All right, Ken, let me ask you this question. Going off of what Alan was saying, which is more important, keeping the White House and keeping Trump in the White House or winning back the House and the Senate for Republicans? Which is the bigger grab?
Well, based on the behavior that I've seen so far, is keeping Trump in the White House. Based on what I've seen so far, So the reason I say that, if you go part and parcel to each one of the guys in the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate, the number one thing that they point to is the composition of the Supreme Court. They are all about making the Supreme Court as conservative as they possibly can. They want to get rid of Roe versus Wade. They want to get rid of a lot of things that they believe has gone the wrong way in the last 15 to 20 years. So, as well as naming of other conservative judges to the federal courts, that is their big banner right now. So if that's the question you want to ask, my opinion is keeping Trump president.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, and when I said the right question wasn't asked, the integrity of the system as a whole, and I mean the system as a whole, we're talking about people's faith in institutions, Congress, the courts, the whole deal. The American public's faith in the federal government, the courts, even though the courts are a backstop at the moment, but this president is putting some serious effort into knocking that backstop down, the knocking down the credibility of Congress, even though Congress does a reasonably good job of that themselves. There are still plenty of people who work hard in the interests of the country on in both parties that represent us in both Congress, and not to mention the executive branch as a whole that this president is completely against.
All right, but think about this, though, for a second. If the Democrats get enough traction that they could possibly take the Senate and own that Senate and the House.
Yeah, it's worth
depending on the margins. Is that a bigger
and that's a possibility.
Is that a bigger nightmare for the Republicans? Because if the Dems take it, then you start using the I word.
So
again.
I haven't done the count on this. And by the way, the I word it is not going to be necessary if the Democrats do as well in the Senate as could happen. The odds of Donald Trump getting reelected in that process are almost zero.
We've been down this road before, Daniel. I give you
the president
November 6, 2016.
The president getting reelected and having a party switch in the Senate? Are you kidding me? Where have we seen that happen before?
Alan?
So I wanted to comment about the Senate. And this question about do Republicans in the Senate place a higher priority on reelecting the president or keeping their majority? For me, it's not even a question. They would want to keep their majority. They don't like this president. They tolerate him. They live with him. They know they have to
be aligned
with him. They enable him. But they don't respect him. They don't like him, by and large. I mean, I would say they're a little more measured than many in that they do see the, you know, occasional positive quality or positive outcome. But they would much rather see a Washington where if there was a Republican Senate to restrain a Democratic president, then a Republican
midterm,
then a Donald Trump with a full Democratic Congress. If you're a Republican senator, that would be the worst of all worlds.
Put another way, they care more about their own job than they do about Donald Trump's job.
Well, no.
And that is simplicity.
No. Look, this is where I agree with them. And if I'm a Republican,
but it's not just their own jobs. It's having the majority with the power of what the majority is able to do.
The job of chairman or chairwoman is much better than minority.
Well, no. But here's the thing: this is where I agree with Alan. Is the fact that look, if I keep the Senate, I can at least keep some control. Even if a Democrat wins the White House, I keep the Senate. That pretty much guarantees me that I could flip the House back red in midterms. I've got a Republican Congress and a Democratic. And a Democratic White House, then it's game on. We look at another 4 years.
Well, you may or may not be able to flip the House. If the Senate doesn't spend a lot of time worrying about thinking about which party is in control of the House, or at least in terms of putting a lot of energy to it.
Right.
They are focused on their own world.
Right. Okay. That being said,
I'm actually looking at the numbers here.
What's
just
that?
Just on this
real quickly, because I'm about 2 seconds away from getting music.
Doug Jones looks like the only potential pickup for the Republicans in 2020. I'm looking at the names. I don't see any other names that they could potentially pick up that are Democrats, whereas lots of Republicans could go down.
We'll see. We got an entire year to go over it. Thanks, guys. As always, Dan Lipner, Admiral Ken. Alan Moore, Oscar, thank you as always for keeping us honest back there. And I am your host and moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back next time for a new episode of the Best Political Talk Show You've Never Heard Of. You can check us out on our website, www.backroompolitics.org, where you can hear all of our historical documents. You can also check us out on your favorite podcasting service at iTunes, Google Podcast, even now Spreaker. Spotify. We're kind of a big deal now. We'll see you again, America. Thanks.